Term elections beginning at 7 Eastern Standard Time from the studios of Democracy Now! In New York. We'll be covering the country. Li Feng's recent investigation for The Nation is Mitch McConnell's frayed ties to a shadowy shipping company. We'll link to it. He's also blogged about how if the GOP takes the Senate, climate change deniers will control key committees. Reporting fellow at the Investigative Fund blogs about money and politics at The Republic Report. And thanks so much to John Nichols, political writer for The Nation. Latest book, Dollarocracy. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking in Washington, D.C. on Thursday. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Also heard around the world at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock straight up. Stay tuned for the Tuesday KBOO Evening News. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Volunteers of America Oregon, committed to helping 17,000 vulnerable people of all ages in our community live better lives each year. You can learn how to help by visiting the KBOO website, visiting the website at voaor.org.
Tune in to KBOO on Tuesday, November 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. for election night coverage. Lisa Loving, Delphine Crescenzo, and Don Merrill will host 3 hours of talk about the elections from the KBOO perspective and include special guests, KBOO reporters in the field, and members of Oregon community media phoning in from all over the state. We'll talk candidates, measures, winners-losers, voter disenfranchisement, and more. Again, that's Tuesday, November 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to announce the opening of Convergence, an audio documentary and sonic artwork by our artist-in-residence, Tessie Word. The opening will be Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. Convergence examines the historical, environmental, and sociological ramifications of living in an imminent ecological disaster area, the tsunami zones of the Oregon coast near the mouth of the Columbia River. Through the use of phonographic recordings, radio transmissions, and original music, Convergence explores and interprets the cultural implications and the psychic terrain of daily life in the tsunami zone. Again, that's Convergence by KBOO Artist-in-Residence Tessie Word, opening Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a neo-Nazi folk band is coming to the Alhambra Theater. It's the only place that will have them.
Drugs are all over the ballots in states across the nation.
Where in the world is Jerusalem? The U.S. Supreme Court is about to decide. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 4th, 2014. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. A controversial neo-folk band that uses Nazi imagery in its performance will be returning to Portland for the second time in a year. Death in June is a band that, according to the show's promoter, Chase Varga, is not welcome at any other venue in the state of Oregon. The band has been barred from performing at other locations because of their use of Nazi imagery and themes in their music. According to the anti-fascist group Rose City Antifa, this represents a dangerous precedent in a city that has a long history of racist violence. They say that the return of the band Death in June, or DI6, is due to a number of factors, including the gentrification of Portland with its attendant race and class dynamics. The last show organized in Portland by Death in June was attended by neo-Nazi fans and known white supremacists. The venue that has decided to bring the band back to Portland is the Alhambra Theater.
The Seattle-based Sightlined Institute today released a new report on campaign contributions from the fossil fuel industry in the Pacific Northwest. Over the last few years, the Northwest has been embroiled in an increasingly heated debate over its participation in fossil fuel exports. Energy companies' plans to build coal terminals, oil depots, and gas pipelines are drawing out protesters, grabbing headlines, and earning plenty of attention from elected officials. So the Institute combed through data published by the Center for Responsive Politics in the Open Secrets online database. For more, we go to KBOO's Jinka Soderberg, who spoke with the author of the report.
We are joined on the line now by Eric DePlace, who is with Sightline Institute and has just written today an article about how fossil fuel money plays in Northwest elections. And I wonder if you could start by talking about some of the top candidates that the fossil fuel industry has targeted in this election.
We tried to basically count up how much money was coming directly from major fossil fuel players. And what we found is that in many of the races that we looked at, there are tens of thousands of dollars. In aggregate, there are hundreds of thousands of dollars flowing into these races with the presumption that they will then influence federal politics.
One of the things I noticed that in the chart that you have in your article is that it seems the fossil fuel industry didn't kind of play both sides of the table this time, that they were specifically focused on one candidate in each race. For example, in the Oregon Senate, the amount that Monica Webby got was much more than Jeff Merkley. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's pretty clear these days that fossil fuel interests are aligning with the Republican Party to a degree that they're not aligning with the Democratic Party, and we're seeing that in their contributions. The Merkley Senate race is very interesting. Merkley has raised about three times as much money as his challenger, and yet his challenger, with a much smaller war chest, raised ballpark figures six, seven, eight times as much from the fossil fuel industry, including from the big players like ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers and Tesoro. So we're really seeing oil and gas money in particular gravitate toward Republicans.
And let's talk about the other races that you focused on in your article. What is the significance of these races and the locations of these districts?
Yeah, well, you know, as folks probably know, the Northwest is in the midst of this very wrenching debate over the future of energy exports, whether we're going to export large volumes of coal and oil, whether we're going to build new natural gas pipelines. And so the Northwest is really in this peculiar spot where it's going from a relatively clean energy bastion and potentially transitioning into a sort of Gulf Coast in the Pacific, where it becomes a major export hub. And so what we were trying to get a read on is how much money the oil and gas industry is starting to pour into these races. And they are starting to pour in some very worrisome amounts, and they're looking to play in most of the contested congressional races, at least the ones that we looked at.
Well, let's talk about Oregon, District 4. What is the location of District 4, and what's the significance? It's Peter DeFazio's district.
Yes. So Peter DeFazio's district has been interesting for a couple of reasons. Coos Bay, which is in the district, is home to a very controversial new natural gas pipeline that would go to a liquefaction site, and then that natural gas would be exported. There was also a coal export site proposed there a couple of years ago. And so what we're seeing in that district is actually a lot of rail money pouring in. Now, some of that is probably because DeFazio sits prominently on the railroads, the relevant railroad subcommittee in Congress. But it's kind of interesting to watch the volumes play out. We have not really seen a lot of natural gas money in that district, not as much as you would think anyway. About $4,000 or $5,000 from the oil and gas industry combined.
And let's talk about another district that is in our listening area here, Washington's District 3, with the Port of Vancouver being a pretty contentious site for the fossil fuel industry. What's happening there?
Yeah, District 3 is really interesting in Washington. It's the ground, sort of ground zero for the oil by rail debate. Tesoro is proposing a huge, maybe the biggest in the country, crude oil by rail terminal that would go there. And what we're seeing in that district is, I think, pretty typical of what we've seen in a lot of other places, where the Republican is pulling down big dollars from the oil and gas industry with much, much smaller amounts and almost functionally nothing really going to the Democratic candidate. So Tesoro in particular, who's the backer of that project, has contributed $5,000 to the incumbent Republican. And then there are smatterings of thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars here and there from other fossil fuel interests in that district. So that's a really interesting one to watch. I'll be interested to see the results of that this evening.
Well, I do want to thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Eric DePlace. He is with the Sightline Institute, has published an article today, How Fossil Fuel Money Plays in Northwest Elections. That can be found on their website, sightline.org. Eric, thank you for joining us on KBOO.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And now we go to Paul Cienfuegos for a weekly segment on taking back our authority to govern ourselves.
Greetings. You're listening to the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Today is Election Day around the country, and if I tried to make just one simple statement that attempted to summarize the entire election, from state to state, from ballot initiative to ballot initiative, from congressional races to senatorial and governor's races, it would be this. Large corporations have once again taken an enormous step forward in their capacity to quote-unquote educate voters about the issues, to manipulate election results, and to set the boundaries of so-called reasonable debate. Here are two questions we need to seriously consider. How much longer are we willing to put up with this outrageous manipulation of our elections by large corporations? And how much longer are we going to hand over millions of our hard-earned dollars and our advocacy organizations' dollars simply to try to keep up with the endless money that corporations are able to spend to defeat our ballot initiatives and elect corporate candidates? This is simply not sustainable. Five large corporations now own most of our news media. A handful of large corporations now own the voting systems that many states use to count their votes. Thanks to a 1976 Supreme Court decision, large corporations can now spend whatever it takes to support or defeat initiatives and candidates. Large corporations now provide the vast majority of the money that is spent by the Democrat and Republican parties. Corporations haven't won the right to vote yet, but they really don't need to, because corporate money now pre-selects their favorite candidates who end up on your November ballot and knocks many of the non-corporate candidates out of the race before the ballots are even printed. Since 1987, large corporations now sponsor the nationally televised presidential debates, hiding behind the very reasonable-sounding organization called the Commission on Presidential Debates. Large media corporations will likely soon get the go-ahead to set up a two-tier internet system, a pay-to-play system, where those with the dough get their website streamed faster than those without, which will make it even more difficult for advocacy organizations to reach most Americans. Every election cycle, the situation grows more dire. Here's just one specific example. In a few hours, we'll find out whether the Measure 92 campaign to label GMO foods has survived the largest assault of corporate dollars in Oregon's history. I'm crossing my fingers that a victory is still possible, but the Measure 92 campaign team has been forced to focus for months on raising money over other priorities, simply because corporate money in elections is a constitutionally protected so-called right of a corporate person, since the Supreme Court said so in 1976. Believe it or not, we can stop large corporations from interfering in our elections. But to do so, we're going to have to learn how to shift our attention away from the one corporate harm at a time form of activism and begin to admit to ourselves that the situation is much more dire than most of us are willing to acknowledge. We're going to have to stop seeing the issues we care about as separate issues. The fact that our food supply isn't safe is directly linked to the fact that our ancient forests are being treated as commodities, which is directly linked to the fact that our planet is reaching or has already reached the climate tipping point, which is directly linked to the fact that our water is being privatized, which is directly linked to the fact that our public schools no longer get the funding they need, and our college students are accumulating a level of debt never before seen in the history of our country. All of the above are merely symptoms of allowing corporate boards of directors to participate in the political process. And the only reason that corporate boards are allowed to participate in these critical societal decisions is that we the people are allowing corporations to exercise constitutional rights. Once we stop being so obedient and begin to strip corporations of their so-called rights, we will discover that their political power was built like a house of cards. Every year that single-issue activists do not focus at least some of their attention on dismantling corporate rights is another year that our activism is not going to be very effective, or at best will succeed in slowing the rate at which things get worse. And we've got to stop acting as if the existing system of governance can be tweaked here and there to make it work for us. It can't. It was designed to serve the corporate elite, the 1%. It's working beautifully, as it was designed. It's high time we stopped begging and pleading with our politicians to pay attention to our issues, and instead start exercising our inherent right to govern ourselves. Want to learn more about how you can transform your activism by integrating an analysis and a strategy for dismantling corporate constitutional rights? I will be leading my next workshop in Portland, November 21 to 23. It's called We the People Are More Powerful Than We Dare to Believe. For more info about this very affordable weekend workshop, visit my website at paulcienfuegos.com. And one final reminder, if you haven't yet turned in your ballot, you've got just 2 hours to do so. Please bring your ballot to your county's election office, or you can Google Oregon Drop Box Locator to find a box near you. The deadline is 8 p.m. tonight. You've been listening to the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my new weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my newsletter at paulcienfuegos.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
If you Portlanders felt a bit warm this fall, it's because you were more than 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal. You were wetter, too. Almost 6 inches worth of above normal rain fell on us in October. Data released by the National Weather Service showed Astoria, Washington, and Salem, Eugene, and Hillsboro, Oregon all had similar wet and warm weather for October. These temperatures put us at 2.7 degrees Celsius warmer than usual, which is in line with but above the 2 degrees Celsius global warming threshold put forth by climate scientists. For more about October's weather patterns, see the statistics from the Warm and Wet October Portland at the National Weather Service Portland.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast. KBOO's Paul Rowland speaks with author Chris Dixon before his Portland visit. At 6, KBOO will be providing a 4-hour election night special from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. with results and analysis of Oregon measures, as well as national results. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight, occasional drizzle between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. Then a chance of rain after 4, with a low around 53. Tomorrow, patchy fog and a 30% chance of rain mainly before 10 a.m., high near 64. Light east-southeast wind. Today in history, in 1862, inventor Richard J. Gatling received a U.S. patent for his rapid-fire Gatling gun. In 1952, Republican Dwight D. Eisenhower was elected president, defeating Democrat Adlai Stevenson. The highly secretive National Security Agency, the NSA, came into existence. In 1979, the Iran hostage crisis began as militants stormed the United States Embassy in Tehran, seizing its occupants. For some, it was the start of 444 days of captivity. The quote of the day is from Lenny Bruce. Everyday people are straying away from the church and going back to God.
It's 5:20, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Loan sharks and their lobbyists really know how to put the ick in ethics. Though they've tried to buff up their public image by calling themselves consumer lenders, their game remains the same ethical mess it's always been. They target poor and financially struggling people, entice them to borrow with come-ons touting quick and easy money, then hook them to installment loans with interest rates up to 36%. At such rates, it's hard for these hard-hit people to repay the bank on time, so most are forced to keep borrowing more money just to pay down the previous loans. To make this even ickier, the sharks are especially fond of setting up their loan offices around Army bases so they can prey on America's low-paid, financially stressed soldiers. The good news is that several state legislatures are taking action to provide relief. The bad news is that their relief is not for the borrowers, but the banks. With an army of lobbyists and a multi-million-dollar arsenal of campaign cash, the industry has already induced legislators to lift interest rate caps in 8 states, most of which have a large number of military bases. The cynical claim of the loan sharks, believe it or not, is that they are suffering financial hardships. These poor-mouthing bankers say that to make, quote, an acceptable profit, they must be allowed to charge borrowers more than 36% interest. Acceptable to whom? One of the largest purveyors of these loans, a subsidiary of Wall Street megabank Citigroup, reported a hefty 31% profit increase last year under the old rate structure. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we have here is a brazen purchase of legislative favoritism by some of the richest financial interests in America, allowing them to increase their exploitation of some of America's poorest people. What exactly is acceptable about that? The whole scheme is a shameful hustle.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Police in Ferguson, Missouri have denied a report released in the Associated Press that they purposely limited air traffic in the area in order to limit media coverage of protests. The controversial report released yesterday by the Associated Press cited unnamed sources in the Federal Aviation Administration. The sources told reporters that the flight restrictions in the St. Louis area in August were put in place in order to keep news helicopters out. But police today released a statement that the reason for shutting down airspace for 3 weeks in August, when the protests were at their height, was for safety reasons, not to curtail the freedom of the press. The police claimed that the restrictions that kept news helicopters away were not even the department's idea. According to Ferguson police, the FAA called police to offer the temporary flight restrictions after hearing reports that shots were fired at aircraft and lasers were pointed at them. The airspace was restricted for 12 days in August amid protests that followed the shooting of unarmed teenager Michael Brown by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson.
Marijuana is all over the ballot this year. D.C., Alaska, and Oregon are all voting on marijuana legalization, while Florida and Guam are voting on medical marijuana. Earlier today, KBOO's Doug McVeigh spoke with Dr. Malik Burnett, policy manager in the Drug Policy Alliance's Office of National Affairs.
Dr. Burnett, we've seen the election results from Guam and a medical marijuana measure won handily there. Could you tell us what that measure actually does?
Sure. So the victory in Guam is pretty significant. 56% of voters have come out in support of medical marijuana, which is great because Guam is conservative politically and has a large U.S. military presence. So it's a resounding victory and a confirmation that medical marijuana has broad support across the political spectrum. Guam requires medical professionals to certify that a patient has a debilitating medical condition and that the health benefits of using medical marijuana outweigh the risks. So it is pretty in line with a lot of medical marijuana laws around the United States.
Okay. Now, it's a conservative area. So this came as a surprise.
Medical marijuana has broad-based support around the country. I think that polls show that Americans support medical marijuana at over 80% at this point in time. So it wasn't a surprise, but given the conservative nature of Guam, we might have not expected such a large result.
So now, does the law go into effect, or since Guam's a possession of the U.S., does it require some sort of congressional approval?
No, the law goes into effect as is. No congressional approval is required.
That's terrific. Now, looking forward to some of the results that are due in later today. What do you expect for Florida? Do you have any idea? They're voting on medical marijuana, of course, today too.
Florida is unique in that it requires a 60% margin in order for it to become approved. We will see how voters come out in support, but what is interesting about the Florida race is that Sheldon Adelson has made the largest donation to drug policy initiative in the history of drug policy initiatives, and he's donated $5 million against the Amendment 2 initiative in Florida. So we'll see whether or not Florida voters can ignore all of the misinformation that has been put out by the No campaign and be able to support medical marijuana and vote yes on Amendment 2. I think that there's a majority of Floridians who support the initiative. It'll just be a matter of getting the vote out. And, 2014 is a midterm year, and a lot of these initiatives are requiring youth support, and hopefully we can mobilize voters, and Florida will be passing, but it's going to definitely be a interesting result that we see later on today.
And now, of course, D.C. is also voting actually on marijuana legalization today, Initiative 71. How do things look, and what does that measure do?
Initiative 71 is an initiative that legalizes possession of up to 2 ounces of marijuana for adults over the age of 21. We have been polling very well here in D.C. On average, 65% of voters support marijuana legalization, so we are hoping to see some pretty significant results here in D.C. Things look pretty good on the ground, and we'll be looking forward to seeing the results once polls close at 8 p.m.
Now, presuming it does pass, does the city council, the control board, or Congress have to approve the law before it goes into effect there in D.C.?
That's correct. So the council has already come out and said that they will support the will of the voters and transmit this up to Congress. The law will sit before Congress for 30 days where they have to opt in order to overturn it. That means they have to pass a resolution of disapproval through both the House and the Senate and get it signed by the president in 30 days, and that's a pretty tall order. In fact, Rand Paul came out today and said that he thinks that D.C. should be allowed to legalize marijuana and the federal government shouldn't interfere. So I think that any members of Congress who think that they can interfere with the will of the voters in the District of Columbia will find that they have a very heavy political lift, given the fact that this initiative has been squarely centered all around racial justice. In the Washington, D.C., marijuana enforcement has been overwhelmingly enforced in a racially biased way. We all know that marijuana use is equal across race, but blacks in D.C. are 8 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than their white counterparts. And so the campaign has been run squarely under the auspices of racial justice, which is a first in the nation for a marijuana legalization effort.
And just so the listeners know, why does Initiative 71 only legalize the possession and cultivation rather than setting up legal sales?
So it is illegal for initiatives in the District of Columbia to put provisions before the voters which affect the tax structure of the government. And so Initiative 71 was unable to account for provisions that would set up the sale of marijuana in the District of Columbia. However, the D.C. Council has already begun hearings to set up a tax and regulate system here in the district, and we believe that they will quickly act to pass a tax and regulate structure focused on racial justice should Initiative 71 be successful later on this evening.
Dr. Burnett, I wish you the best of luck. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. And if I could quickly say that I think that Oregon voters should definitely vote to support Initiative 91 in Oregon, because that'll go over great.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
KBOO is doing a live election special this evening from 6 to 9 p.m., but some results are already in from some of the East Coast races. So we'd like to have a live update from Riley Turner, one of KBOO's volunteers working on election coverage. Riley, can you fill us in on some of the election results that have been confirmed at this point?
Yeah, thank you, Jared. Taking a look at some of the ballot measures of interest on the East Coast, the results we have so far are coming in slow trickle. Amendment 2 in Florida allows medical marijuana to be sold and distributed. Now, that's coming in at about a 54% yes. That said, there's something unique about Florida's governmental structure in that they require a 60% yes on the vote for this law to take effect in January. Now, if passed, it will be the first comprehensive medical marijuana law in the southern United States. We have a very similar story unfolding in Washington, D.C. right now. As early as this morning, we have a 65% yes vote on Initiative 71, which would allow adults to cultivate and possess as much as 2 ounces of marijuana for personal use. Now, this law is unique in that as it's being passed in Washington, D.C., an area of the United States that does not have any state-level representation, the law will be passed on to Congress to be voted on whether or not that will get approved. Something of much chagrin to Washington, D.C. natives that they don't have a state representative to fight for them on that level. So we will see as the months progress into 2015 how this law actually plays out. But it's looking like, by vote, the population of Washington, D.C. is currently in support of recreational marijuana. Now, in New Jersey, public question number 1 carries a strong 64% lead in the polls. This law, on the surface, is aiming for bail reform in New Jersey, but there is a positive side effect to its passing. As well as allowing judges to refuse bail to those they find to be a danger to the public, question number 1 significantly lowers the bail threshold for non-trafficking drug charges. The hope is that while dangerous persons can remain incarcerated, that New Jersey will see a drop in prison recidivism stemming from low-level, non-violent crimes. This law and its victory so far highlights a growing trend in America to treat drug abuse and addiction as a sickness rather than a crime. Looking for the congressional races on the East Coast, the results we have in so far look like in the Senate, we have 11 Republicans elected over 7 Democrats currently. In the House of Representatives, it looks like we have 40 Republican representatives elected, 34 Democratic representatives elected, and 2 independent representatives elected, both in Wyoming. Now, in the House here, as far as governors go, it looks like we have 11 Republicans and 7 Democrats, And in the Senate, it looks like we have 40 Republicans and 30 Democrats with 2 independents. Now for the House, it looks like we have 60 Republicans and 39 Democrats. Sorry, that was my mistake.
Oh, thanks, Riley, for that update.
A ballot initiative in Maui County, Hawaii, would prohibit genetically modified foods from being grown or tested in the county. The initiative prohibits growth, testing, or cultivation of genetically modified or engineered crops. It also imposes a temporary moratorium on genetic modification and engineering operations in Maui until environmental and public health studies are conducted. Activists are largely targeting Monsanto, the agriculture company responsible for the most genetic modification experiments and operations in Maui. The company donated a record sum to the campaign against the initiative. Monsanto and other agrochemical companies also donated record amounts to oppose the GMO labeling measure on this year's Oregon general election ballot.
A voting law in Kansas is causing trip-ups at the polls and a slew of suspended voters. The Secure and Fair Elections Law contains several newer provisions requiring photo identification. This summer, 97-year-old Beth Hiller was among a number of seniors turned away because copies of their IDs were not fit to scan, one poll worker said. A provisional ballot was not issued to Hiller, as is required by law. Later, the local election commissioner apologized, and that poll worker was fired. Problems relating to the new law have resulted in nearly 22,000 suspended registrations. That's 20% of Kansas voters. The Secretary of State's office says this is due to a lack in proper documentation. A provision of the Secure and Fair Election Law requires proof of U.S. citizenship. Secretary of State Chris Kobach argues that the law is working because it has already caught more than a dozen, quote, aliens. He says, I think it's really irresponsible to suggest that citizens are being denied the right to vote. A recent review by the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, found that voter turnout in Kansas has reduced disproportionately among young people, new registrants, and among Black and Latino voters. A federal prosecutor is on duty today to address any possible election fraud and voting rights violations in Kansas.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
As far as we can tell, there's like five old white guys on the Supreme Court are the only ones who really believe that corporations are people. And so our objective as a movement is to get the U.S. Constitution amended to say that corporations are not people. Money is not speech. The government may, in fact, regulate political spending.
Wisconsin moved to amend volunteer Richard S. Russell. On this election day, as real people cast their ballots, they make their way to the polls through an avalanche of corporate money. Russell and his fellow activists at South Central Wisconsin Move to Amend are working to get a constitutional amendment that overturns Citizens United, the U.S. Supreme Court decision giving corporations the same rights as people. Russell says it is a tall order, but it is doable.
That is an ambitious agenda. We are under no illusions that it's going to be easy, but we have tremendous public support behind it, and we think that it can be done. We have 15 or 16 states which have already petitioned Congress to enact such an amendment. Now, they haven't all said exactly the same thing, and Wisconsin is not among those. But there is a groundswell of pressure from the citizens to do something about it.
The day after Election Day, Russell and others supporting Move to Amend will turn out in Madison, Wisconsin for a Roaring 2000s-themed friend-raiser at the Speakeasy at Cargo Coffee East. Just so you know, to get into the Speakeasy, you'll need these code words. Corporations are not people, my friend. Workers and their unions are working nationwide to get voters out to the polls. So much is at stake with control of the U.S. Senate. But in Kentucky, union leaders and activists know that should Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell win there, his momentum could also flip some state House seats. And that could pave the way to make Kentucky a so-called right-to-work state. Republicans there want to pass that anti-union law they call right-to-work, but so far, they've not had enough votes in the state legislature to do it. In four Republican-dominated red states, voters will decide whether or not to raise state minimum wages today. In Alaska, Arkansas, Nebraska, and South Dakota, it's a popular issue. Polls show the minimum wage increases are likely to pass. Labor is hoping voters turning out to approve minimum wage hikes may also vote for labor-friendly candidates. In San Francisco, there's a $15 an hour city minimum wage on the ballot, also expected to be approved by voters.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities.
A battle is playing out in the U.S. Supreme Court, which could affect the U.S. relationship with Israel and Palestine. The case in question involves a young boy who was born in Jerusalem to American parents. His U.S. passport reads Jerusalem as his place of birth. His parents would like it to read Jerusalem, Israel. This change could have a huge implication on U.S. government policies towards Israel. Currently, Jerusalem is not considered part of Israel, and its final status is pending negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Both Israel and Palestine claim Jerusalem as a capital. If the Supreme Court were to rule that the passport could say Jerusalem, Israel, it would be a de jure recognition of Israel's takeover of the city. But the ruling would also impact Palestinians born in Jerusalem as well, as Palestinians living in the West Bank. Many Israelis living illegally in settlements in the West Bank also have U.S. passports, and this could affect them as well. In the argument to the Supreme Court, the lawyer for the boy argued that not only Jerusalem, but every part of the West Bank should be considered part of Israel.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, November 4th, 2014. Israeli troops stop Palestinians from praying in Al-Aqsa Mosque and demolishes homes nearby. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Hundreds of Palestinian Muslims had to perform dawn prayers in the streets and alleys of the old city of occupied East Jerusalem after Israeli soldiers and police officers denied them access to Al-Aqsa Mosque for dawn prayers. Local sources said that the soldiers continued to prevent all Palestinian males below the age of 40 from entering the mosque during dawn and morning hours for the third consecutive day. Dozens of Israeli extremists invaded the yards of Al-Aqsa Mosque during morning hours under heavy police and army deployment, local sources added. Similar to previous invasions, the attack took place through Al-Mughrabi Gate, while the extremists conducted provocative tours in the entire area of the mosque. Staying in Jerusalem, Israeli soldiers invaded the town of Silwan, south of Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem, and demolished four Palestinian homes. The Wadi Hilwa Information Center in Silwan has reported that the soldiers invaded Wadi Yasul neighborhood in Silwan and demolished two homes belonging to former political prisoner Khaled Abu Rajab and Isam Abu Sabah. It added that soldiers, accompanied by bulldozers and personnel of the city council, invaded the neighborhood nearly at 6 in the morning and surrounded Wadi Yasul neighborhood before invading the home of Abu Rajab and forcing the family out and demolishing their home. The soldiers also demolished two more homes belonging to members of Al-Subh and Burkan families in the same neighborhood, while at least 36 Palestinians have been rendered homeless. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Tuesday at dawn two Palestinians in Beit Umar town, north of the southern West Bank city of Hebron, and handed a third a military order for interrogation. Army also invaded Al-Fadr town south of Bethlehem and kidnapped one Palestinian. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, November 4th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Stay tuned. Certified Languages International, or CLI, is one of several Portland-based companies extending services to aid in stopping the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. CLI, in partnership with Translators Without Borders, is making education about the virus more accessible to educators and healthcare providers in the region. Translated posters, guidance packages, and an animated video will be available to the large Fula community. About 40 million Fulanis live in Africa. Kristen Quinlan is CEO at Certified Languages International. She says, with so much confusion around the prevention and treatment of Ebola, both in the U.S. and abroad, education is one of the key pillars in halting the epidemic. Kristen Quinlan sees the video as an essential way to educate in areas where cultural practices like washing the dead can spread the diseases. Touching them on a very emotional level is going to have the widest impact, Quinlan said. CLI joins Portland-based Medical Teams International and Mercy Corps in extending help to West Africa.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Doug McVeigh, Jim Thompson, Jared Dantzler. Our engineer is Sequoina Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Young.
I'm Jared Dantzler. And stay tuned now for an interview conducted by KBOO reporters. At 7, it's Democracy Now!
That's coming up tomorrow.
7 a.m. tomorrow.
Right.
At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland, talking with Thomas Lindsay, the co-founder and executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. The topic will state of the community rights movement and electoral politics. At 9, Political Perspectives with Lisa Loving and Joanne Hardesty. The show is called Elections, the Day After. At 10, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre and the